Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we can certainly reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Now here's a special section in the Good Old Days magazine. It's entitled Good Old Days on the Radio. And this item is entitled The Adventures of Michael Shane, Detective. The stories about a hard-boiled Irish detective became a staple of whodunits. And this item was written by Carl Amari. In March, we celebrate St. Patrick's Day. So I thought I'd write about Michael Shane, the red-headed, at least in the novels, Irish-American detective of books, film, and radio. Through the 1940s, the hard-boiled private detective became a staple of American folklore, along with the frontiersman and the cowboy. This type usually had a capacity for hard liquor and cigarettes, an ability to recover from bullets, knife wounds and blows to the head, and a need for less than an hour's sleep a night. Michael Shane possessed those qualities to a degree that was superhuman. Based on novelist Brett Halliday's Private Eye, the radio series that bore the detective's name was first broadcast over the Mutual Don Lee Network on selected West Coast stations for the original 2 years, 1944 to 1946. When 20th Century Fox announced production of several Michael Shane motion pictures, Mutual quickly introduced the radio program to the masses on a nationwide scale, and the Michael Shane radio show underwent the first of many title changes. Radio reviewers were quick to criticize Michael Shane, Private Detective, as just another of many Private Eye programs, even though it was skillfully scripted and produced. The program, starring Wally Mayer, was almost dropped after a few weeks on the air when women's groups objected to its violent scenes and applied pressure on the network. By order of the advertising agency, the whodunit was quickly toned down, and suspense and scientific detection took precedence over violence and brutality. Psychological analysis and insight into the criminal mind were also given greater emphasis. For 2 years, a syndicated version titled The New Adventures of Michael Shane was produced in Hollywood. Replacing Walter Mayer as Shane was aspiring actor Jeff Chandler. Fresh out of the Army and on the way to film a screen test, Chandler had been involved in a car accident that resulted in a large scar on his forehead. After struggling to find work in Hollywood, Chandler turned to radio, and Michael Shane was his first major role. It wasn't until Chandler had fulfilled his contractual commitment to the radio program that Universal Studios signed him up for a 7-year contract, and his screen career took off. The Adventures of Michael Shane returned to network radio in 1952, starring Donald Curtis, who 3 weeks later gave way to Robert Sterling, followed by Vinton Hayworth. In 1960, NBC Television cast Richard Denning, one half of Mr. and Mrs. North, that was from 1952 to 1954, as Shane in an hour-long TV series that ran opposite The Twilight Zone on CBS. As good as the detective series was, it couldn't compete with The Twilight Zone and only lasted 32 episodes. Note to readers, you can receive your free 30-minute classic radio episode of The Adventures of Michael Shane, Detective, courtesy of Good Old Days, via digital download by going to www.classicradioclub.com. And this was The Adventures of Michael Shane, Detective, by Carl Amari. Now here are a few items from the bits and pieces section of the Good Old Days magazine. This first item is entitled A Wonderful Water Slide. This was sent in by Lynn Keyes Tudor. A rain shower was a favorite event back in my good old days. If there was no lightning, my parents would turn us loose outside. Charles Vaughn and I romped in the South Mississippi downpours. That was during the Great Depression in the 1930s. We had few toys, but a wonderful childhood. When the rain stopped, we rushed to the red clay ditch that ran from up a hill on our roadside. It became a wonderful water slide as the rushing water had carved channels to ease our ups and downs. When the water slowed to a trickle, we went in to take off our clay-stained clothes. We were so tired, but so happy. Our country neighbors probably called us that Wild Keys Bunch. This was A Wonderful Water Slide by Lynn Keyes Tudor. This next item is entitled Printed Feed Sacks. I was born in 1941 on a small dairy farm in the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina. Although I was a girl and the only child to my loving parents, I was a bit tomboyish and wanted to be outside with my daddy most of the time. The dairy feed for the milk cows came in 50-pound fabric bags that measured about 24 by 38 inches and were printed in various designs. Going to the feed store with Daddy was a joy, for I could pick out which bag to get, and I knew how many it took for Mama to make a certain item. For instance, her pattern for a long-sleeved, floor-length, double-breasted housecoat with a scalloped collar and fitted waist required 5 feed sacks. It took some time to get enough fabric since the print I wanted was not always available. But the day finally came when there were enough sacks to make a beige with pink flowers robe for me and a mauve robe with white flowers for Mama. We were so happy with our new robes and felt as glamorous as movie stars. My school dresses did not take as many feed sacks, and I was happy with each new dress Mama made for me. She also made little dresses for my dolls, which I played with when I couldn't be outside with Daddy. The uses for the feed sacks were not limited to clothing. They were sewn into aprons, pillowcases, pot holders, tablecloths, and so forth. Scraps were cut into small shapes to make quilts. Our entire family benefited from those feed sacks. Even the cows, for they were happy to see a feed sack coming into the dairy barn. Oh, those were the good old days. And this was Printed Feed Sacks by Glonna Brim. And this next item is entitled The Prank That Backfired, sent in by Wayne McLaughlin. My mother told me the story that happened when she was a child. I'm 88 years old, so this took place a very long time ago. She was attending a one-room schoolhouse with some of her brothers and sisters. One of her brothers, Kenneth, was an ornery kid, always getting into mischief. He and one of the other older boys were assigned the task of adding coal to the stove when needed. The stove sat in the middle of the room. The stove pipe went straight up, made a turn, and then ran to the end of the room. One day, Kenneth got up and added coal to the stove. Not long afterward, the other boy added coal to the stove. Soon after, there was a large bang. The stovepipe came down, and everyone was covered with soot. One of the buckets of coal had contained a shotgun shell. There was no way of knowing who'd put the shell in the stove. It could have been Kenneth, but it could have been the other boy, too, so the teacher didn't know who to blame. Whatever the case, everyone and everything in the room was covered in a layer of dust. This was the prank that backfired by Wayne McLaughlin. And here's a letter from the editor of the Good Old Days magazine for the June issue. She says, "Welcome. Whether you played a casual game at the park with a taped-up bat or played in an organized little league game, there was nothing quite like playing baseball or softball as a kid. Oh, the nervous excitement of walking up to home plate, hoping you would hit the ball deep into the outfield. At a full count, you settled into position and took a deep breath as you waited for the pitcher to release the ball. You hoped to hear that glorious whack of the bat as it made solid contact with the ball, and the roar of the crowd as you ran the bases. Then again, maybe you'd hear the ump yell the dreaded, 'Strike three!' Our parents could be counted on to cheer for us when we got that great hit, or to console us after a tough loss, and to provide support to us through all of life's many ups and downs. In this issue, our readers share their favorite stories about their parents as well as their memories of what well-loved summer pastime. Perhaps, like many young baseball players, you dreamed of becoming a professional baseball player. Or perhaps your future career was inspired by a toy police officer. Our readers also share with us their dreams of what they wanted to be when they grew up. On behalf of the Good Old Days staff, we hope you enjoy the May-June issue as it takes you back in time to those wonderful days of playing baseball and make-believe." And speaking of playing baseball, this first story is entitled "A Double Play at Home Plate." An explosive ending turned into a game for the memory books. This was written and sent in by Richard Whitaker. Although the California winter of 1955 brought with it some cold days, the weather never stopped us from grabbing our wiffle ball equipment and having our weekly Saturday morning game. I was 10 and a half years old and in the fifth grade at John B. Monlux Elementary School in North Hollywood, California. It was the last Saturday morning in January when six of us formed up in the middle of the street in anticipation of a heated game. After flipping a coin and choosing sides, the game began. At the top of the seventh, Scotty Miller grabbed the wiffle bat and stepped up into the plate. Leaning forward, I went into my pitcher's stretch and then suddenly stopped. "Come on, Rich," Miller shouted. "Pitch the ball." "Wait a minute, Scotty," I shouted. "There's a truck coming." Looking down the street, I watched as an old pickup truck drove slowly toward us. As it did, I saw a man standing in the bed. He shouted into a handheld megaphone, "Play ball, kids. Little League Baseball is coming to North Hollywood." Pulling up to where we stood, the truck stopped. "Here, boys, each of you take a handout and share it with your parents. It'll tell you when and where to register, so you can play in the new North Hollywood Little League." Anxiously, I grabbed a paper and read it. Tryouts were scheduled for the next Saturday. When the day arrived, a group of us rode our bicycles to the registration and tryouts. Upon arrival, we were organized first by age and then by the position we wanted to play. Since I wanted to be a catcher, I stepped into that line. By the end of the day, I was one of four selected to play that position in the majors. Grinning from ear to ear, I was placed on the Sydney Vanton Vanguards. That didn't last, though. In the off-season, I was traded from the Vanguards to the Valley Plaza Optimists, who had lost their starting catcher when he moved from the neighborhood. Our season went well, and as the end neared, we found ourselves eligible to play against the Los Angeles Examiner Angels in the championship game. The Angels were a group of big, aggressive ball players. At the top of the list were two kids who were the biggest and toughest of any in the 60-player league, Larry Gooch and Billy Strong. Both stood at least a head above any other player and outweighed the rest of us by a good 50 pounds. Added to this, both Gooch and Strong were driven to win the championship game, whatever the price. And with wild man Billy Strong on the pitcher's mound and Gooch behind the plate, the odds of them being victorious were high. The championship game was scheduled for Saturday, July 23, 1956, at 1:30 p.m. As I had done all season, I was designated to play catcher, with Chris Overton pitching. The game was hard fought, but as we approached the top of the seventh inning, we had a lead of 7-4. Unfortunately, Chris began to tire. Although he struck out the first batter, a single by the next batter placed a man on first, and then a double by the second batter saw runners advance to second and third. Strong, the tying run, stepped to the plate. I watched as Coach Bodak paced the dugout, deliberating whether or not to take Chris out or have him walk Strong and then face Gooch, the most powerful hitter in the league. He decided to walk Strong. The bases were now full, with the winning run at bat. As the catcher, I knew that Chris had two pitches in his repertoire, his fastball and the drop ball. I also knew that Gooch could hit anything, but especially a fastball. Chris's first two pitches were drop balls, each of which Gooch swung at and missed. From behind me, I could hear the umpire shout, "Strike one," and then "Strike two," as he held up two fingers on his right hand. My next sign to Chris was for another drop ball. As he leaned over to catch the sign, Gooch stepped from the batter's box and tapped the cleats of his shoes with his bat. The cat-and-mouse game had begun. Chris stepped from the mound, stretched, and then placed his right foot back on the rubber. Gooch glanced back at me. "This game is over, Whittaker," he said, grinning. Again, I gave Chris the sign, but this time he shook me off. I knew what was coming, a fastball. Then the pitch. Crack! Gooch hit the ball squarely, which sent the ball flying to the far corner of left field, and just inside the thick white chalk line, making it a fair ball. The runners on second and third had anticipated the hit, and before anyone realized it, they had crossed home plate. When Gooch hit the ball, I stepped up and took a position in front of and to the left of home. I watched Johnny Elam, our left fielder, as he scooped up the ball just as Strong was rounding third. On one bounce, Elam's throw landed squarely in my glove. I watched as Strong lowered his shoulder, aiming directly at my chest. With a violent collision, he drove his body into mine, an action that drove me off my feet and sent me airborne flying backward. With the ball tightly secured in my glove, I held both my glove with the ball high above my head. "You're out!" screamed the home plate umpire as he raised his right arm and with his thumb raised signaled the out. Then, while I was still on the ground, I heard Coach Bodak scream from our dugout, "Rich, Gooch is rounding third." Standing, my eyes locked onto the figure of Gooch as he tapped third base with his toe and, running at full speed, took aim at me. Lowering his right shoulder, he brought his arm with a closed fist across his chest. I spread my feet, bent at the waist, and stepped into the charging behemoth. Just before the impact, I tightened my grip on the baseball. Then, for the second time in less than 10 seconds, I endured a collision more violent than the first. As Gooch's right shoulder drove itself into my chest, I was thrown again into the air and backward, an action that slammed me forcefully against the wooden backstop. Then, amid the dust and shouts, I held up my mitt with the ball still secured. With another guttural cry, the umpire again screamed, "You're out!" as he raised his right arm and with his thumb raised, signaling the third out. Our dugout went wild. The team flooded the field, and our fans were ecstatic. We were now the champions of the North Hollywood Little League. At no other time had there ever been a double play at home plate that helped to clinch a championship title for a group of young boys, many of whom would go on to have wonderful lives as they continued to play America's favorite pastime, baseball. And this was A Double Play at Home Plate by Richard Whitaker. This next story is entitled, At Least Try It. A sprinkle of sugar was Mom's secret weapon. This was sent in by Carla Cooper. In the late 1940s and 50s, adults, sometimes on purpose, exposed us children to new, different, and perhaps unusual foods in an effort to broaden our palates. Whether our reactions were positive or negative, those occasions made for lasting memories that we still talk about today. Following World War II wartime meat austerities, my mom continued for years to use what the government had earlier labeled grade 2 meats, for which it had helpfully provided recipes to consumers. At our dinner table, we occasionally ate liver and onions, beef heart pressure cooked with rice and onions, and tongue. The latter was sliced and garnished with mustard and pickles in our schooltime brown bag sandwiches. Also, for sandwiches, often waiting in our icebox, as we called our refrigerator, even after the icebox was long gone, was Braunschweiger, that is, liver sausage, and of course, bologna. Budget concerns influenced shopping choices, and Mom valued the health benefits of organ meats for 6, then 7, and in time, 8 growing children. Persuading us, at first, to eat foods that were good for us, Mom sometimes sprinkled them with sugar. Above all, she used this technique with vegetables like spinach. We were encouraged to at least try new foods. At Christmas time, it might be a taste of sweet wine. One year, instead of chicken or turkey, we ate duck. Being the childlike and unsophisticated gourmands that we were, we graded it as oily. Canned hominy came and went. Canned okra suffered the same fate. It was deemed slimy. A jar of pickled pig's feet, a delicacy to some, arrived one year as a gift for the family and was not repeated. But little mandarin oranges from a Florida gift basket were cute and made just a mouthful. As a rule, Mom orchestrated all garden harvesting, canning, grocery purchases, and meals. But Dad, as a creative type, liked to put his spatula in, so to speak. Two occasions stood out. One time in Chicago, where he worked, he asked a restaurant server at lunch to identify the ingredients in the house tartar sauce. Afterward, we always included diced onion and chopped dill pickle in our simple sauce recipe to accompany our favorite fish sticks. New foods continued coming into our lives as we grew. Homemade pizza and American chop suey were successes. I remember Mom's concerted efforts to introduce us to foods outside our usual Irish, German, post-war, homogenized American fare, which included the occasional White Castle and McDonald's hamburger, and her repeated pronouncement, "One mouthful, at least try it." That last short turn of phrase, an unbreakable rule back then, has proved to be a good slogan when facing most of life's new and unfamiliar occurrences. Well, thanks for joining me today. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good news.